This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is, in fact, the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. And today's guest will be and is Dr. Yaki Sillier, somebody I've met years and years ago. I think it was about 30, 31 years ago, when his organization, the Institute for Security Studies, was just coming into being, and they were still based in Johannesburg. Now he's got these fancy offices in Pretoria and in various other parts of the continent. ISS had an important role in South Africa as part of the transformation agenda, especially at that point with the armed forces and reimposing civilian control over the military early 1990s that required a shift away from the security state to a more normal civilian control in a society that was moving away from some very difficult times, as most listeners probably remember. Yaki is the founder and former executive director of the Institute for Security Studies, and now he's moved up the food chain, as it were, and he chairs its board of trustees, and he heads the African Futures and Innovation Program there. And he's got professorships in various universities. And he's written a number of books, which one of them was a bestseller in South African terms a couple of years ago, The Fate of the Nation, one of those future scenario efforts that posits doom, disaster, steady as you go, and a bright future, and allows readers to figure out whether or not they're going to get which train they're going to board at that station. But there are other books, and he's been working now, most recent, on a project which makes some heavy use of analytical tools and mathematics and computer modeling to look at the possibilities of the continent's future challenges and opportunities in Africa tomorrow and pathways to prosperity and all kinds of important thoughts like that. We'll talk about that, but first, because it's just in the days after the BRICS meeting, I wanted to draw on our guest's expertise, and I think I'll put it this way, his sort of modest optimism rather than exuberant enthusiasm, to look at three topics. And we can take them sequentially. One is the outcomes that have arisen from the BRICS meeting. And the second is, what in the world is going on with this sudden wave of coups on this continent? And then third, as time allows, we're going to talk a bit about his African Futures Program. Yaki, good to have you with us this morning.
Brooks, thanks very much for the invitation. As you say, it's been some decades, and it's good to see that you're still hanging in there, and we both are still fit and able to do our work and enjoy our lives. So thanks for inviting me. Very great to see you and to talk.
A little bit more gray hair and gray beard than we used to have, I suspect, but we're still around. So let's get right to it. The BRICS meeting was in Johannesburg a week ago. Much enthusiasm in the popular press and among many analysts and commentators. I remain confused. I look at the list of new members. To me, it seems like it's a step backwards on any consideration of support for human rights among nations and internationally. And I'm confused about the criteria that might have been used for its new members. And not say, and I just drew up a little list in my head of countries like Mexico and Chile and Morocco and South Korea and Indonesia and Malaysia, all of which seem to have much more successful economic circumstances and economic management. How do you see it? What do you make of this?
So ahead of the summit, I was fortunate enough to be on a TV discussion program with Naledi Pandor, the minister in charge of international relations, and we chatted about this. And she, at the point a few days before BRICS, said that the Sherpas had prepared a list of guidelines for the expansion of BRICS membership. Now, the Sherpas, as you know, are the, let's call it, the foreign affairs diplomats who prepare things for the summit, and said that these guidelines would be provided to the leaders who would then make a decision. And at the same time, she said that She would be surprised if the members, the countries that have joined the New Development Bank would not become members of BRICS. Now, I took that as a clear indication of who would then be successful in terms of their application. And but it didn't pan out exactly that way. The four countries, or the countries that eventually were announced, Iran, Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, I think as a result of quite a bit of horse trading done amongst the leaders themselves. So there were criteria prepared, but for example, I'm quite convinced that it was Brazil that tried to make sure that Argentina became a member. I'm quite sure that there was agreement largely around Saudi Arabia and the UAE, because the two of them are large oil producers. They are large clients and providers of oil, particularly to China, and bringing them in provides a vehicle through which you can look towards the end of the petrocurrencies, in which the fact that oil was paid for in dollars, but in actual fact could then be paid directly in local currencies. I think we'll get to that, I assume, sort of geostrategic effect of that. Egypt is a member of the BRICS National Bank. Ethiopia, I think South Africa pushed quite hard for Ethiopia. But of course, the big discussion was, I think, around Iran, given that it's under sanctions, given its poor human rights record. And I think it's very evident that BRICS knows what it's against, if I can put it that way, which is in the way in which the global order is structured, a resentment against the Western neoliberal economic and political system. But it's very difficult to see what BRICS is for. So looking long term, I think BRICS Plus, the new name, I think, for it, is going to struggle in terms of trying to define what it stands for as what it stands against. I think broadly, BRICS represents in a sense, a disillusionment with the current structure of the international system. And it represents a growing desire to see change to a system that was established in 1945, 1946, which still, and that holds for the UN Security Council, it holds for the IMF and the World Bank, and the world has changed. And the global governance system just no longer provides, I think, for a changed world. And that's what, that I think is the glue that holds BRICS together. I don't think there's anything else really. And they're going to struggle to moving from there to define an alternative. On the other hand, I think that the West, if you want to use that broad, or if I'm using that broad collective term, will not move without pressure. And what BRICS is going to do, I think, and this growing disillusionment, is applying a degree of pressure. It reflects this growing sense of disillusionment. So that's how I see it.
We're going to take a quick station break, commercial messages and things like that, but we'll be right back with our guests. I get the acronyms jumbled. I'm death on acronyms, unfortunately. But I'm going to pose a question to you just after we come back about what you've just said. But first, these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, we are back. This is the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Dr. Yaki Sylvier of the ISS. And we're talking BRICS and African coups and other things. Just before our break, you were positing the challenge for this grouping in its old or its new configuration. It's easy to say what it is, quote unquote, against, and rather harder to say what it's for. But look at the list of new countries. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have done really well under the current system of oil sales. They effectively have a near lock on the way the price structure is set. Ethiopia, up until it had its most recent set of civil wars and conflicts, was a leading nation in terms of annual growth and attraction of foreign investment. Argentina, on the other hand, has been one of the largest borrowers of funds from the IMF because it hasn't been able to manage its currency properly, or its government budgets for that matter. Iran is sort of an outlier on that. obviously, because it is, as you say, under sanctions. And then Egypt, of course, has been enormously well served in terms of foreign assistance, even if it hasn't managed necessarily to use it all. But in any case, it has a permanent grievance, it seems, with another new member, Ethiopia, over the waters of the Nile River because of the increasing number of dams and water channeling that is taking place on that river. If all that's true, then just how the more members you have, doesn't that say that the more members you have, the more difficult it is to define yes. what an institution is for rather than just simply against?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think challenges will reflect, I think, because BRICS also apparently works by consensus. So having consensus amongst those very diverse countries is a huge challenge. Of course, the dominant country is China. And it is a country that is shortly going to, well, in our view, in about a decade, will overtake the United States in GDP and the size of its economy. And many people use purchasing power parity, but I think that's incorrect. If you look at market exchange rates, it overtakes the U.S. in about 10 years' time in terms of the size of its economy, even as it is slowing down. China is the factory of the world. It drives global growth. It's hugely important for, in a sense, the global South. And China, of course, is in a different league to what the former challenger to the United States was, the USSR, which no longer exists. China is truly a global economic and trading partner, the factory of the world, as it's so-called. And clearly, it is China, to a degree, that is driving BRICS. India and China are at loggerheads with one another and will be, I think, increasingly so looking ahead, because you have two regional powers that eventually, almost inevitably, will bump heads, as it was in Europe elsewhere. When you have two rising powers, they often challenge one another. So I think there are large issues and challenges with regard to the future of BRICS Plus, much less so than the G7. But I made the point in something that I've written about it, that I think what most commentators are not factoring in is that they tend to look at the G7 in isolation. And I think that the G7, one should rather look at the West than the G7. In other words, North America, Europe, countries like Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, because that's the club of rich Western countries that share a number of values and orientations. And even an expanded BRICS Plus, even once BRICS allows additional countries, like some of those that you've mentioned, Indonesia, even possibly Mexico, they will not compete with on incomes with the West will remain much richer on an individual basis than BRICS. And this is while BRICS has much larger population component, 2-3 times the population of even the so-called West that I term. The West is technologically much more advanced. It is much richer. But size of the BRICS plus economies will in about 20 years time overtake that even of a combined West. So you're heading for a future that rich countries remain overly representative in global governance systems that house the majority of the world's population and that are deeply affected by the decisions that are taken by the West. Let's just take the one issue which was much, much discussed at the BRICS, which is the dominance of the dollar.
That was going to be the next question. We were going to talk about what I termed de-dollarization.
Yes. You know, it's just simply, we're both in South Africa. When the Federal Reserve changes interest rates, the South African rand plummets. Why? We have absolutely nothing to do with the domestic reasons why Federal Reserve changes interest rates. Yet we are inevitably punished quite severely by changes in interest rates in the U.S. So the fact having a single dollar as a reserve currency is, of course, of hugely beneficial for the United States. But it is very detrimental to a country like South Africa and to countries that have to trade in dollar. So I think there's a degree of almost natural rebalancing that I think is happening as the South is rising and as the South becomes more economic prosperous.
I'm going to take some modest disagreement with that judgment you just offered. As I see it, the reason why most trade takes place and why most countries hold reserves balances in dollars is largely because it's convenient to have one.
Convenience is a factor without any doubt. And there I would fully agree with you.
Rather than, you know, trying desperately to balance your reserves in 11 or 12 different countries. But also because historically, at least for the last 50 years, the dollar has been seen by almost everybody, whether it's a country, a business, or an individual. It's been seen as a source of stability. If you put your money in a U.S. bond 5 years from now, it's still going to be there rather than having gone up in a puff of smoke or a cloud of devaluation. I would argue, you can school me on this, if I were sitting in South Africa as a currency manager, if there was such a field, I'd much rather be dealing with dollars than with the managed currency that is the renminbi yuan in China, where there's a company that actually assigns exchange values.
And there's no doubt that the renminbi is not as freely available. It doesn't the market doesn't set at rates and all of those factors that you mentioned. But let's first go back to the potential future stability of the United States. There are various indices that track democracy, and the U.S. has recently given Trump's attempted a coup, which is how I would describe it. The U.S. has been downgraded a liberal democracy, firstly. Secondly, also some of the rating agencies have now started to downgrade the U.S. The first has happened. So the future of the U.S., which has been globally dominant for more than a century, maybe pushing that a little bit, I think it's fraying a little bit. So that certainty, that reserve currency status, that has meant that everybody places their money in the U.S. and has given the U.S. the ability to run a deficit that is just unimaginable for anybody else. I think that's going to change a little bit going forward. And then what most countries are doing is they are spreading their risk a little bit. They're still investing mostly in euros and maybe in Swiss franc and so on, but no longer exclusively in euro. And over time, the Chinese currency will also become probably more tradable. It just doesn't make any sense for a South African who wants to buy oil from Angola to have to convert South African rand into US dollars and then pay for Angola's oil which is in kwacha, whatever the local currency is, and have that sort of trilateral kind of arrangement, because as soon as the dollar goes up, it punishes both of us or it has an effect on both of them. Why cannot we not trade in other currencies? And I think that de-dollarization, it's not a replacement of the dollar, in my view. It is that countries will also start trading in local or regional currencies. But there's, of course, a huge problem with this, because if I buy stuff from a country in using our domestic currencies, the only way that balance is if we have more or less we export and import the same from one another, because else the client or the supplier ends up with a huge surplus of currency in the currency that is being traded. So this is a notion that I advance of, yes, de-dollarization is I think probably appropriate and necessary. Doing that in effect is going to be very, very difficult. It's easy to talk about this, but I don't think it's going to happen. It's going to be a slow incremental process at best.
Yeah, the people I read all say that, yes, there is a rebalancing coming, but don't hold your breath and by all means don't rush out and try to get a forward position in Angolan escudos or whatever it is, just yet. Be a little more cautious on that. You know, if you want a forward position that's 50 years on, that'd be a good
I would more or less agree with that. I think that's more or less the kind of time horizons we're talking about. But that process has now started and there's a momentum behind it, which wasn't the case before.
We're going to take another quick break. We're speaking with Dr. Yaki Sillier at ISS. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we shall be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking today with Dr. Yaki Sylier, and we are doing all things BRICS, African coups, and Africa's futures. One last question or thought on BRICS, and then we'll shift the topic slightly. Give me your thoughts on the nature of the organization itself. It's an annual gathering, but there's no secretariat. There's no charter. Yeah. There's no specific set of goals and objectives. There's no five-year plan. There is, as you've noted, the China-India tussle or sharp elbows. The cruel fact, perhaps, that Russia is increasingly an oil well for China rather than an independent arbiter of its future. In comparison, the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which largely is the group of countries you were talking about earlier rather than the G7, does have pretty much all of those things. And yes, it functioned quietly and yet reasonably effectively within limited terms.
Yes, no, and it's for that reason that people normally compare the G7 to BRICS, because the G7 also doesn't really have a secretariat. You know, it rotates between countries. So these are clubs. These are not trading structures or countries that share currencies or trade to any large extent. That's why, which is, as you point out, quite different to the G7, to the OECD countries and so on. So again, BRICS is a pressure group. It reflects where the world is headed. It reflects a disaffection with current structures and it in a sense reflects the growing power of the global south. You know, Fareed Zakarias from GPS wrote a book many years ago, 10, 12 years ago, that basically was not about the decline of the West, but the rise of the rest. And I think that phrase still largely holds. This is not the decline of the West. What this is the rise of the rest, that the global south is becoming, that's where growth happens. That's where, to a degree, going forward, innovation happens. And certainly that's where the economic locus of power is shifting towards. And it doesn't mean that the West is somehow declining. It's just growing slower. It's aging. It is perhaps less innovative. It certainly is, in population terms, quite declining, in that sense, declining. And the question really is, can you head to a future in which you have a small population of rich people in Europe and North America that tries to maintain their quality of life and their standards against a growing population of young, poorer people in Africa and elsewhere? Is this a world that is this a stable world that that provides opportunities for all, or will eventually migration and the challenges associated with that, such as populism, also become a challenge for the rich West? And I think that's the issue that I'm grappling with.
That's a natural segue to my next topic for you, which is this new wave of African coup. I mean, years ago, there were a lot of them. Then there was the rise of, at least a semi-rise of democratic traditions in countries. And now it looks like it's been a U-turn back to militarized coups across the Sahel. And then most recently, in of all places, Gabon.
Yeah, I think that of course is partly influenced by, let's call it, the declining influence of the power of the liberal democracies to set the agenda. But I think that's a relatively minor factor. I do long-term forecasting. We look at some of these factors, and I think much of that has to do with the impact of COVID. COVID had a dramatic impact on the ability of government revenues of African governments to spend on education, security, health, and so on. And the impact of a succession of shocks has now come to bear. And that succession of shocks was firstly the 2007-2008 financial crisis, followed by COVID, followed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and a downturn in global growth, which has punished African countries significantly in terms of food, fertilizer, and everything else. And at the same time, what you have in Africa is a rising young a growing youth bulge of better educated people that are better connected Institute that can see the living standards elsewhere in the world, but there are no jobs. There's no economic opportunity. And we have a gerontocracy of leadership in Africa. And there certainly is something specific about the extent to which the French Francophone Africa feels that France still played an inordinate role in the continent, more so than in the former British or Lusophone colonies. So I think for me, if I look at the structural drivers, I think that those successive economic shocks have play a big role. Of course, there are other factors as well, more immediate factors. But if you have in Equatorial Guinea, you've had a family that's been running this country for 50 years and you've had flawed elections. And then where this family enterprise has now come to an end because democracy, because there is no space for democratic change in that country, because like in Zimbabwe and elsewhere, the opportunity for democratic change is cut off for its population.
Isn't that something like what we used to call the discontents of the lumpen proletariat? When was the last time you heard that phrase?
Yeah, yes. Well, I haven't been to what was used to be called Shell House, the ANC's. There they would certainly be speaking of lumpen proletariat. But I think what this is relative deprivation, which is a term that you probably also know quite well, which is where expectations keep on rising, but compared to what others have. And that certainly is just not being achieved in Africa.
I mean, 50 years ago, individuals would have been relatively isolated within their own community, their own country. Now everybody has at least one cell phone or access to one, and they get to see what's going on everywhere else, and they can talk to everybody else, and they can read all manner of stuff, whether it's lunatic nonsense or thoughtful, reasoned prose.
And they're better educated. They're connected, they're better educated, they have higher expectations, and as you say, they can see what happens elsewhere. They have access to media, and they are governed by old men that is completely disconnected to the demands of today's young African population. And that's so, what's so ironic is that Europe, for example, has got much younger leaders. It's such a much of an older continent. Yet Africa, we are stuck with, you know, guys that have seized power and just stay in power and do not allow democratic change.
I'm going to leave hanging the observation that although in Europe there are younger leaders in most of the major countries, there is one country in the West, a big country in North America, seems to have people who they're octogenarians in charge.
Well, I mean, you know, for a country like the U.S., to have somebody like Trump elected as a president is a disgrace. There is no other way to frame that. He would be a perfect African leader in terms of his lack of values and the issues that we say the West aspires for.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Dr. Yaki Sillier of ISS.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is, in fact, The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. My guest is Dr. Yaki Sillier, and we were talking about the way and reasons for the what appears to be a growing wave of coups in Africa. And, of course, my mind was on Niger and Gabon, and at least in the back of my mind, thinking about questions of the kind of election, quote-unquote, that has just taken place in Zimbabwe. And that, of course, would allow us to think about the stability of a country like South Africa over the long term. And I'm not going to ask you to speculate on that precisely, but to talk about your African Futures program, which takes a long, large, deep look all simultaneously on all kinds of variables about growth, stability, and progress on the continent. And perhaps you could explain it briefly and, you know, give us a thumbnail sketch of what it is you predict.
Brooke, thanks. After I stepped down as executive director of the ISS in 2015, I full-time really engaged in long-term futures because, as the name indicates, the Institute for Security Studies was largely engaged with broad human security issues. But I became increasingly frustrated that we're dealing with the symptoms of the problem and not dealing really with the drivers of prosperity and growth and democracy and so on. So eventually I wrote a number of books, have been doing a lot of work on this. We have a partnership with the University of Denver, and we use their modeling platform, which is known as International Futures, and we do long-term forecasting on Africa's potential. So we typically, for every African country, model the impact of, for example, what would be the impact of an agricultural revolution, of better education, of investment in health and WASH infrastructure, the continental free trade area and so on. And we do that long term out. We do that in partnership with the NEPAD, the New Partnership for Africa's Development, which is an agency of the Africa Union in Midrand. So we model what is Africa's development potential. And then we apply that at every African, for every African country, and then engage with governments to try and feed that analysis into national level planning to see what can be done, what should be done to unlock more rapid development. Because only more rapid development, in my view, although there's lots of debates about this, will in actual fact sustain democracy and respect for human rights and so on and so forth. So that's, in summary, is what I do.
And if that's the case, I mean, this country has lots of people who seem to take delight in modeling the future. I mean, there, your work, and then there's Clem Suttner, and there's Franz Grenier, who's done it, and then there are other business organizations that, that have tackled this. But if we had to boil it down to what are the main drivers? What are the things that could, that not only should be done, but given real circumstances, can be done that would pitch that curve upward rather than allow it to sort of dribble along?
Yeah. Are you talking South Africa now, specifically?
Well, you get your choice. South Africa specifically or the continent as a whole, which is least difficult.
Well, let's start with South Africa. It's a country we both stay in and love and would love to see improvements in. And the problem in South Africa is that the political party in power has a particular worldview and a particular way and of governing, and it does not believe in evidence. Many of us do forecasting, and we could present what needs to be done to unlock the electricity challenges or logistics. But the reality is there's simply that for a variety of historical and other reasons, we are locked into a particular development pathway, and we have certain policies that are aimed at redressing the past, which condemn us to poor growth, to rising inequality, and no matter what evidence you place in front of the governing party, they just, you know, they believe in ideology. They don't believe in evidence. So, short, my view, and I've written quite a lot and do quite a bit of work on this, is that only political change, whether that is coalition governments or opposition parties coming to power, will really unlock better growth in South Africa. Because it is very often ANC policies that drive the collapse in municipal, metropolitan, local government infrastructure. Politics, I think, in the case of South Africa is very important. In the rest of Africa, the modeling that we do, I mean, we look at structural stuff. So we look, for example, at the extent to which Africa's very rapid growing population is both a boon, but is also the largest constraint on Africa's development, because we have such a large number of young kids coming through the system that you can't build schools and educational facilities fast enough. But in economic terms, the contribution that labor makes to growth is still several decades away in Africa. Our population is so young that labor is, in actual fact, a drag on growth. and will be the case until about 2050. And at young, at low levels of development, labor is really the most important driver of economic growth. So that's the kind of things that we look at. We look at the importance of a manufacturing transition and what is happening in much of Africa as we are deindustrializing. What they refer to as premature deindustrialization from relatively low levels, whereas the most successful growth path globally has been through manufacturing. We are transitioning into low-end services, and that is not really transforming our economic structures.
And those financial services, even financial services, are not really a very good sponge to absorb the thousands and thousands and thousands of new entrants to the labor market unless they have a whole basket of skills that do not appear to be made available to them.
Yeah. So what Africa has in abundance is low quality labor. Low quality, I mean, in terms of education and health. And what the world wants is it wants educated, productive labor. The rest of the world is investing in labor saving technology, while the main thing that Africa has is low quality labor. So that's one of the long-term challenges beyond climate change that will constrain Africa's development long-term. If we don't get on top of our demographics and don't embark on an agricultural transition, a manufacturing transition, Africa will struggle. And none of that is possible without the continental free trade area, because the difference between Africa, North America, Europe, India and China is there are large internal markets that allow inward investment. That is not the case in Africa. We have 54 or 55, take your pick, small countries, very small economies that don't really trade with one another. And only if you unlock the potential of that block to trade with itself, and then because by trading with one another, we improve the value add of our goods, go up the manufacturing curve, and then eventually we can become globally competitive and be part of global manufacturing chains. And that is really what is required. Africa's, it's a well-known figure. Africa trades 15 to 18% of our traders with one another. If you go to North America or Europe, it's like 60, 70, 80%. And you must trade with one another because that's the way in which you learn, go up the value chain, and eventually start building value that allows you to become part of global value chains. And that can only happen through the continental free trade area.
My goodness, the ghost of David Ricardo comes to my conversation with you this morning.
Yes.
There he is. He was smart then. He's still smart. One of the things I've noticed, every time I go to a store to buy an article of clothing or a household good, some sort of kitchen thing, I always try to figure out where the thing was A, designed and B, manufactured. Now, for the longest time much earlier in my life, if I bought something here, there was a reasonably good chance it was both designed here and made here. If I bought a men's suit, the high likelihood was that it was made, at least in Cape Town, anyway. Now it's not. And for a while, everything seemed to have been made in Shenzhen or Shandong or... I've noticed in the last 2 or 3 years, there has been a shift that sort of... Just before COVID, I started picking this up. I was finding things made in Ukraine. I was finding things made in Tunisia and Morocco and Bangladesh and Malaysia, Philippines, men's clothing that was imported to here through some sort of vast supply chain process. But I was finding virtually nothing left that was made here. And
you're obviously quite a shopper and quite a fancy dresser, but that apart. So what is happening is that one of the reasons why China originally developed so rapidly is that very low labor costs. Labor was cheap. And Chinese labor costs are no longer as competitive as they were. And therefore, manufacturing, particularly of textiles, is moving out of China. To Southeast Asia surrounding and to the rest of the world. The rest of the world is again becoming competitive. And the main problem that South Africa has is that labor in South Africa is very expensive and of poorly productive, partly because we have a very strong labor We are very unionized. Labor is an ally of the governing party and so on and so forth. So, that's globalization. South Africa, the largest competitor to South Africa in Africa, which is our natural market, is China. Nobody can compete with China, given just look at the volumes. And we have to find our niche where we can industrialize, where you can go up that value chain, and where we can trade. You know, we've lost out. Our textile industry is literally, there's some regeneration, but it's closed down significantly. So big issue for the country.
We're going to take one last ad break, commercial message. We're speaking with Dr. Yaki Silier, ISS. We're talking about all manner of things, and we're going to come back after just another message on Brooke Spector. This is The Deep Dive, and stay tuned. We'll be back in a sec.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is indeed The Deep Dive. Brooke Spector is your host, and we're finishing up our conversation with Dr. Yaki Silier of the Institute for Security Studies. And we've moved from conversation about the outcomes or lack thereof with the recent BRICS meeting and its expansion to considerations of the questions around this newest wave of coups in Africa and the discontent of young populations across the continent, and then to his current project, the African Futures Project, which has heavy analytical database focus. But if you had to make, in summing this up, I'm going to ask you, if you had to make one recommendation to the government that they would listen to, that people here would say, yes, that's it. That's what we're going to do because you said to do it. What would you tell them?
Well, that's a tough one because there is so much. And unfortunately, many of the fundamentals of a government policy drive the collapse of local infrastructure that we see. I think the single most important recommendation would probably relate to reform, allowing the civil service to be based on meritocracy and not on representativity, and holding government officials accountable instead of trying to build rules and regulations to counter corruption. Those two go first. The first one of them bumps up against the requirements for employment equity and all of those things, which are important. But it has brought disaster to South Africa because what we've tried to do in South Africa is, because of growing corruption, we've built a state that is run by regulation and where nobody's held accountable. When I wrote my book on South Africa, I said ANC stands for absolutely no consequences. It still is largely true because people, and this holds very certainly the case in government, nobody's held accountable. Nobody's given authority and held accountable. We try and control things through rules, regulations, and forms and ways that inhibit innovation and progress rather than doing the reverse. So many things that South Africa should change, but I think competence within government would go a long way, and that can only happen if we move away from many of the rules and the regulations and the representation issues that we have at the moment.
I think the word that wasn't in what you said specifically, but which was, I think, implicit in it, is a government of consequences.
And we have no consequences in South Africa. If you travel by road in South Africa, you will see the extent to which it's impunity. You can do whatever you want. You don't need to stop at robots or stop streets because nobody holds you accountable. And we need to reestablish the rule of law and respect for the rule of law in South Africa. And that's absolutely critical. And that would require a huge change in the way in which we govern ourselves.
I'm going to end here on this enormously optimistic note that you just given us. Oh, dear. There's a whole other conversation there. But we have been speaking with Dr. Yaki Silier of the Institute for Security Studies. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. We'll be back again next week with another guest, and we'll look at something else that is of consequence for us all.